is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1016, a conversation with Pat Olive. Welcome to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. I'm your host, Adam Chapman. This is episode 1016. It's a conversation with Pat Olive. And for those who've been noticing that the episode's been going up typically on Saturdays, you'll notice this episode is early, coming out on Wednesday, the 22nd of November. That is because Pat's new book, which is the Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars Battle World, issue one, is actually dropping today. Thanks to Marvel Comics, I was able to read this in advance so I could speak to Pat on the podcast about it. And we thought it'd be a nice way to synergize with the release of the book if we had a conversation about his work on the book coming out at the same time. If you want to check out my prior conversations with Pat, you can check out episodes number 278, 810, 450. And if you want to see him and Chuck Austin, or listen to him and Chuck Austin, you could check out episode 850. First half of this episode, we actually talk about Edgeworld season 2, which was issues 6 to 10 of Edgeworld, which was a Comixology original. That is a lot of fun. It's not necessarily a fun read in some ways, because it's a very serious read. Some of it's very harrowing. You've got some great pacing, but it's a very entertaining read, I'll say that. I really enjoyed everything about Edgeworld, both season 1 and season 2. So I love being able to pick Pat's brain about it and really go deep diving a little. We're hoping that maybe when the second trade paperback comes out for Edgeworld, which is next year, in the early spring, I think it's March, that'll be able to have Chuck Austin and Pat Olive on the same episode once more to do another creator commentary, to really kind of get into the weeds, not just artistically, but also from a writing standpoint with Chuck. Really excited for everyone to listen to this episode. It was a lot of fun to record. Pat was a great guest. He's been on the show, four times. This is the fifth time. So he's just such a thrill to talk to. And he is an artist who I've enjoyed for a long, long time. I still remember as a kid reading issues of Untold Tales of Spider-Man and loving his art there. It's always a thrill to be able to talk to, one of your childhood artists who shaped your interpretation of certain characters in the medium. So being able to talk to Pat is always a thrill. Anyways, you can always email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com, rate the show on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever they're calling it now. And you can also listen to us on Spotify. Thank you so much for listening to the show. And next week, it's going to be Sean Isaacs coming back to talk specifically about Green Arrow issues 1 to 5, which is a real thrill as well, because he's such a fantastic artist. But more than anything, he feels like he's the fan who made good, kind of like Zeb Wells. He's just a lot of fun to follow on socials, etc. And it was great to have him back on the show to really do a deep dive into how he's, approaching his work on Green Arrow and also his work on Thunderbolts previously. Anyways, thank you and enjoy the show. Bye-bye. Pat, welcome back to the Comic Shenanigans podcast. How are you today?
Oh, very good, Adam. Thanks for having me.
So somehow it's been, I think, 160 episodes since I've had you on last, but an even larger gap because I took a year off. The last time we had you on the show was episode 850, and it was you and Chuck talking about Edgeworld.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
So speaking of Edgeworld, in the intervening time, you had a second season come out. So I was just rereading it today, and it is absolutely fantastic. I have to tip my hat to you guys. It's quite a whirlwind, and it's the second and third chapters of the second season are so riveting, and the pacing is incredible, and it's just wholly engrossing.
Well, I appreciate that, and I know Chuck appreciates that as well. It's a labor of love for both of us. It certainly has had its ups and downs, but we're extremely proud of the book, the world we created. The fact that you've had the reaction you've had to it is extremely gratifying, that someone connected to it, that somebody enjoyed the experience. The second series The trade paperback coming out through Dark Horse Books for the second series will be out in March. Anybody that's not interested in reading an online comic or a digital comic can pick it up at the local comic shop in March. So, but we're very proud of it. We certainly hope that there is more to come. That's the idea, is that eventually there will be more. For right now, we're just thrilled to have the second series out there.
Now, I'm curious just in general, because we've talked a lot before about how you adapted your art style to understand the guided view and how that was going to work. But that was also, it's interesting because just in the last few years, there's been so many changes with what Comixology is and was, and now it's going to be folded in wholly to Kindle in the next month or so. So how do you feel as someone who was, as part of the Comixology Originals kind of imprint and working on this labor of love between you and Chuck, what has it been like to also have to navigate the other things that have been happening in the digital comic space?
Well, I think to a certain extent, it we're in a situation where as the guys that are creating this story, our primary concern is the story itself, the characters itself. A lot of what's going on right now, like Comixology being folded into Kindle and the ups and downs with Comixology in general, it prompts, occasionally, frantic emails and texts between Chuck and I, like, what does this mean? But in terms of the nuts and bolts of it, a lot of that's outside of our control. We don't get a lot of say in, what happens in those situations. So we just kind of have to roll the punches. I don't know what the new folding into the Kindle means for us. I think anybody that's ordered any of their material previously, my understanding is, should still be able to access that through the Kindle. As I mentioned before, we're certainly hopeful that we would be able to continue the adventures of Edgeworld at some point. But what that means in the brave new world of Amazon and Kindle, I don't really know quite yet. So we're a little bit more in the situation where we're just kind of watching and waiting to see how it plays out.
Now, as your story itself plays out, I mean, obviously, like, 10 leaves on quite the cliffhanger.
Yes, right.
Which is very different from, obviously, issue 5 and the first run, because that was much more, like, there was, obviously there was so much more story to tell, and you definitely left it on a moment, but not in the same kind of climactic, in the middle of an action type of... What was behind that decision to kind of end issue 10 that way?
Well, I think when you're doing something new like this, the first 5 issues, we didn't know if we were going to get more than 5. We didn't know what the reaction was going to be. So you kind of set up your story with the idea that if we could get more than 5, that would be great. We would certainly be able to have enough story as a springboard to keep us going. But if we didn't, it would still round out enough where we thought, okay, if that had to end, then that would be okay. But once the first series came out, and it became... at that point, early on, it became the most popular Comixology original series that they had. Then the idea was that we would be able to continue, that there would be more story to tell. And really, it's kind of one of those things where once we got rolling and thought we would have another series or maybe another series after that, you kind of get the idea, at least at that point, that we could leave the second series on more of a cliffhanger, something a little bit more dramatic, with the assumption that we would be back for a third series. Now, we're hoping that will be the case eventually. The gaps were not what any of us had planned for necessarily, but I think that's what kind of led to the decision to end 10 that way as opposed to 5, which we thought maybe we would have to be done in 5. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, too, is that once the story starts growing and Chuck's, writing furiously to create this that second series, at times it just kind of takes a life of it. It takes on a life of its own, and the ending kind of presents itself just as a matter of creative course, where this is just kind of how the story was headed, And that's where the next five really felt like it should end. So it was a combination of a couple of things.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm curious, like, with I noticed especially in this the kind of second season that the Doctor seemed much more prevalent a character than she had been in the first. Yeah. Was that, again, one of those things, as you said, like, now that we have more space, we can kind of let the world take over as opposed to, you know, where we were more linear in the first five issues?
I think so. I think that had a lot to do with it. Plus the fact that, you know, Chuck and I had been working on this and developing these characters for a while before the book ever came out and before we actually started telling real stories. And of course, as we talked about in previous interviews, that you know, we just kind of started doing this as a way to do a creator-owned project. Both of us were interested in exploring that idea. We didn't really have a home for it when we started, so it was really just for us in the beginning. But then when we found a home at Comixology and really had a space to kind of develop these characters, Doc became I think she was a great character in the first series, but then in the second series she does become more prominent, and I think part of that is just who the character is. We both just fell in love with that character. She has so much so much background that Chuck developed, and it's just such a rich character that I think she almost kind of demanded to be more of a feature in the second series, so we certainly listened to her. So
you guys definitely came up with a fun, I thought, very interesting way, and I guess you kind of did this in the first series as well, of a way to weave in Killian's backstory in a way that felt natural without just being a flashback. And so, like, the fact that you have him, you know, in the tank and they're trying to save his life and having these kind of these moments of his history kind of flittering through his mind, I thought it was a really organic way of being able to show more of that backstory and show just how tragic it is. What I thought was interesting in terms of your character acting throughout this second season, it felt like the modern day Killian started being like kind of breaking through that stoicness that we saw in the first season. Yeah. And we started him looking sadder, I guess, if that's a simple way of putting it, like as he's reconnecting with this kind of these lost memories. And you really do a great job of really demonstrating the pathos of those moments, because you still have the hard-bitten Killian, and then you'll have something will happen, and then you see this softness. And it's a really interesting trick, because to be able to pull that off, like, it's still the same guy, but you just have this subtle inflection and suddenly he looks so different, but in a very organic way, if that makes any sense at all.
Oh, it does. And I'm thrilled to hear you describe it that way, because really that is kind of the balance that we were trying to get to, is that how do you get this character, who is such a tragic character? I mean, he certainly follows some of the kind of the Western sheriff stereotypes in terms of the stoic hero character, but how do you then get across the real tragedy that is this character's background? And you know, that can be tricky. And so much of that comes from Chuck. I mean, his developing the character and how he tried to steer both of those pieces of Killian's personality. It was basically, I think, in some ways, it came. It was my responsibility not to screw it up. So, but yeah, that was the trick. And I think, again, because we had a second season, because we thought that, you know, there would be more to come, I think it allows us to experiment more and to play around with more and develop these characters more. That once we got through the first series, we couldn't do earlier that we could do once we thought we had more time to play. So mm-hmm. I think that played a big part in it. But I'm really happy to hear that was your takeaway from it, because that really was a tricky balance for sure.
I'm curious about, you know, the antagonist in The Calling, that two-part arc, a really creepy visual, but like what kind of went into developing that, the visual for the character? Because, I mean, obviously the book is a Western, so he does kind of fit into that kind of Western style, the mustache, but then you also have, you know, the intricacies of the line work kind of on his face, and it's unclear exactly what that is, but I mean, it's a very haunting visual. So what kind of went into developing that antagonist?
Well, my memory of it was that it was Chuck's idea to do the scarring on the face. I think that's how it worked. But when he first described the character, that visual just kind of jumped into my head because it was it did have that sci-fi Western idea with all in black, the flat-rimmed black hat. Mm-hmm. That's a classic, you know, Western villain stereotype. And, immediately think of like Lee Van Cleef and some of those old Clint Eastwood Westerns. So some of the long black coat, some of that stuff just presents itself pretty naturally. Mm-hmm. As to who the character was going to be. And I think part of it too was that in the beginning of the series, there was some getting used to this idea of how much Western, how much science fiction, where to kind of draw the line. And by the time we hit the second season, the second series, I was pretty comfortable with that balance. So I kind of knew pretty quickly when I read that character what I had in mind for him.
Hmm. Now, question, at what point in the process did you have the third eye and the fact that the eyes were kind of staple shut?
That was Chuck's idea. When the hat comes off, the third eye was there. I thought that was a great visual. I wish I could say that was all my idea. It was Chuck's.
It's a great idea. It's an unsettling scene when you see him, like, because he's got his mouth open, his eyes are right. Shut, but then this eye is open, and because of the way that the dialogue box, you almost think that the eyeball is talking directly. Like, it's just something really haunting about it, even though, like, you see the mouth open, obviously that's where it's coming from, but I don't know if it was deliberate or not, but it makes it feel like it's the eye speaking and not the rest of them.
Well, if it worked, then we'll take credit for it.
What I find is an interesting balance that you guys do, and I guess this is more of a Chuck question, but it's interesting to see how you guys balance the, because technically it's all a flashback, right? Because we're actually, you know, in the eyes of a historian trying to learn more, and he's trying to understand more about his place in it all and what that means.
Correct. So there's all those different levels, and that is that flashback within a flashback, and that was so that took some juggling to do for sure.
When handling that, like, it's an interesting visual style, and I guess maybe this is up to the colorist as well, but just from a color palette, it also feels very apart from the rest. Was that always a very distinct decision so that there'd be a visual cue so you would kind of know, okay, this is far different than the other, you know, kind of level?
I think, that wasn't necessarily a specific note from me. That was really just Lee doing what Lee does. I mean, he's a super talented guy. Mm-hmm. He's established such a great look for the series. I can't imagine anyone else coloring that because he really just kind of understands. He has a great ability to establish mood and feeling, which dovetails perfectly with what we want to do. So that, those decisions, I think that's, you know, I tip my hat to Lee for that.
I do think I have to also tip my hat to Chuck because I really like the naming of some of these issues. Like, I love the name Historian's Bias. Like, it's a great, about it just really grabbed me. It's like, oh, that's just a great title for a story.
Absolutely. When I saw it, I just, a big smile on my face. It was, that was a nice job out of Chuck. That was really great.
A very different feeling is seeing the name of a story called The Meat Market.
Right.
That's a different feeling.
Very much so, as the story develops. And I think that was, we wanted to go, there's this idea of going a little darker and a little bit more horror direction. And so I think that there were, and this also goes back to the idea that, you know, a lot of the stories that would come after the second season, Chuck and I have talked about, planned out. So there's kind of a flow to, the type of stories we were going to tell. So, as an overall arc between the first series, the second series, what we would hope would be, future stories, you get a chance to do some quieter stuff, so maybe a little bit more science fiction-y stuff, and then some more horror stuff. So it allows for us to play around with a lot of different genres within the overall arc of Edgeworld.
Hmm. Now, one thing, so reading issue, I guess, 10, and that's one where Chuck talks about the bloody handprint and what that actually means, which I actually did not realize. With that history, like, what was it like for you to... I mean, you guys are doing the story, but also there is a deeper meaning and something that's kind of being channeled here in terms of what you're doing. How did you approach how to draw that? And again, because you're telling a story, but also you're doing something out of respect to something that actually does exist. And you're kind of telling your own parable on that. How did you approach the art to make sure that felt right?
Well, I think that it begins. It begins with a good story. It begins with, you know, the words on the page that Chuck provided. But also, you're right. It was something that I had to be aware of. How to exactly handle that? And there, you know, it's a dramatic and emotional storyline. What you want to do is you want to get across the emotion of the scene, the emotion of the characters, without being too overt about it, because you want to bring readers in without pushing them away, if that makes any sense. I mean, you could have taken that visually. I could have gone in some directions where it could be a little bit, would be maybe considered salacious or something over the top. Which would not be appropriate for the story that we're telling, or the characters that we're creating. So you want to make sure that you get across that emotion without, you want to draw them in, not push them away. Trying to make sure that everything feels connected and believable in the story that we're creating.
Mm-hmm. I thought, again, reading the missive from Chuck, and like again, I did not even know what that symbolism was, and it did make me take...
I didn't either. When he first sent it to me, I had no idea. I really wasn't sure what that was. So.
Well, it's interesting because I took pause because then I thought about it because, you know, there's a prominent Marvel character. Echo has a white handprint on her face, and I had never... Yeah. And she's a native character, and I don't know if that was cognizant when they first made that character in the late 90s, but it definitely made me reframe that in my head. I'm like, well, wait a minute. Yeah. I had no idea of that.
I had no idea either. And I'm sure that was in the back of their heads when they created the character. It was something that I was unaware of. But when Chuck mentioned it as such an important part of this character, important visual part of the character, I was all for it. I mean, it just really, I thought it was pretty important.
As you guys were putting together season two, did you find, like, obviously, when you're working on season one, you don't know what anyone's going to think. So you're hoping that everyone's going to love it as much as you guys love working on this project. But then it comes out, it's a really highly regarded series on Comixology originals. And so now you're working on season two. Which one was more challenging? Was it the one where you're laboring on something, but you don't know if it's going to hit yet? Or now you know it's hit, and now you got to, you know, reach that same level to make sure that you continue to entertain people at the same level?
Well, I think it's the cop-out answer, obviously, is that they're both challenging in their own unique way in terms of, you're right. I think that the first issue did present challenges because you're still, not only were we trying to make sure that we told the best story that we could and we were kept our fingers crossed that people would respond, very happy that they did, but it still was, even though Chuck and I had been developing this before it showed up in Comixology, there was still, especially for me, visually, Chuck had written a bunch of scripts and we were talking about different characters and stuff, and visually, I was still kind of getting used to the world. I did a bunch of sketches and designs, getting used to the idea of this environment. So the challenge in the first issue was not only hoping it connected with somebody, but also just the challenge of getting used to this world, even though I created it visually, just kind of getting used to the language of the world. Now, the second series has its own set of challenges. Not only do we want to make sure that we continue to tell the kind of stories that it connected with the readers, like the first series did. But then the challenge then is how to not only maintain that arc, that kind of quality, but at the same time, how to develop characters where both visually and through their development that they wouldn't feel like boring. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like they wouldn't necessarily feel like we had just retold the first series again. Mm-hmm. So that's a big challenge, is that you can certainly say, oh my God, this first series, you know what, that did pretty well. People seem to really like it. Let's just do that again. And that's just not what we wanted to do. That's not what we had in mind. So I think that that's, you know, that's the challenge of the second series. And then the second series, of course, from a visual standpoint, a little less challenging for me in a way, just because I had become a lot more comfortable in the world. I did less thinking about, you know, what people looked like, how they interacted, you know, the moonlight and Killian's office, all that kind of stuff. It's just, at that point, it was second nature. So there, you know, in that respect, the second series was a little bit easier.
In that second season, I mean, you have some really standout covers. What do you think was your favorite one?
Well, I think that the I like the one, and I don't have it in front of me, so I'm not sure which issue. The one where they're in the alley.
Number 9.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I like that one because of just the idea. I think it created enough tension and mystery at the same time, which is, I guess, the idea of a good cover is that you want to create some kind of mystery because you want someone to pick up the book. Now, obviously, in a digital context, that's a little different, but you want to create a cover that, you know, intrigues, but you know, that creates some mystery that allows makes the reader want to find out more, pick up the book, read the issue. And I thought that one did that pretty well. I hope.
10 is a standout, but it's unsettling. But that's the one where you have the character holding the body, like the bags of the bloody bags, and there's just like dead right. bodies around. Yeah, like it's definitely visually arresting. I'll give you that.
It is. Oh yeah, exactly. And I think that you know, that certainly also would hopefully get people to pick up the book and say, "What the heck's going on here?" Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's also, I thought that was also a pretty effective cover as well. It was a little bit more graphic, a little bit more, in your face, I think. You know, hey, as long as they're effective, as long as they get people to read what's inside, then, you know, that all works for me.
For sure. Again, I'm just looking at them again. Like issue 7 has that great cover because you have all the shattered glass and you have... You know, she says in them so that you can kind of see that's what's happening as he's getting shot, which is a fantastic visual. And then the one, I guess,
that was fun to do. And at the time, I thought, what a great idea. And as I'm penciling and inking all those little shards of glass, I started to reconsider if that was really the wisest choice. but still overall, I was pretty happy with it.
Now, something about the colors of this one, but the cover to issue 8, which I believe is the cover of the upcoming trade, is very, again, compelling because you have the white space, you have the orange kind of at the top, and then you have all the characters kind of in the shadow of the body of the antagonist, which is a great look as well. Was it a pretty easy decision, or was it even your decision at all to choose which cover would be the cover of the trade?
Well, I think it was kind of a community decision, just because I thought that from a design standpoint, that was probably the most effective of all the covers. Mm-hmm. It harkened back to kind of a more of a almost like a movie poster idea. I had looked at some Bob Peak movie posters to get some ideas for that one. So I think from a design standpoint, it was the strongest of any of them. And I think that was a reaction from, you know, everybody at Comixology, from Chuck and, you know, everybody that we had look at the cover. I thought from a design, everyone felt that that was the strongest design. So that should have been the trade cover. Mm. And I was totally fine with that.
A question about when the first series went to trade. So it's obviously, like, you've been working in the industry a long time. You've seen a lot of your covers on the stands. You know, what was it like to have a collected edition of a creator-owned book of yours? It's one thing when it's obviously on digital, but suddenly it's in actual print. What was it like to you personally to be able to say, like, this is mine? Like, this is no one else's. This is, well, me and Chuck. This is something that we have together.
Yeah, and I think that was the point of Chuck and I giving this a shot, is to have that moment. Now, we were both very excited about the idea that Comixology was going to be a digital first company. I think digital comics certainly have a place in the future of comic reading. Certainly it's had its ups and downs. I still think there's a value there. I still think there's a future there. So we were happy to be part of that. But at the same time, I'm an old school comics fan. I like the tactile feel of a comic book, just like a lot of readers. And so to actually hold that in my hand was an enormous thrill, an absolutely enormous thrill. I mean, it was basically the culmination of, almost 2 years of work for Chuck and I to put together this little world, and to have people respond to it as they did was very gratifying. And then to actually hold it in my hand and be able to flip through it, that was just super exciting. And I'm just, I can't wait for March when I do it with the second series too.
Absolutely. Before I kind of switch gears and move on from Edgeworld for a second, is there any other Edgeworld thoughts that you want to kind of share?
Well, I think it's just something that, and I keep, we talked about this before, is that it was a labor of love. I mean, it really was something where Chuck and I had the opportunity to create this world on our own, and to get to live in that world, to get to play with these characters that we created that never existed before, it was incredibly gratifying. And I remember in the first series, and then maybe probably somewhere in the middle to end of the first issue, drawing the moonlight, I think, at that point. And you just kind of realize that I'm not looking for reference. No one else has done this before. This is all do I put this, chair in this place? Do I have this character wearing this? I don't. That's all up to me, and that's so. It was just the whole process has been super gratifying, and I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that we can revisit it.
So, a question I don't know if I've asked you before, and if I have, forgive me for not remembering the answer. Are you still working on traditional boards, or have you switched to digital?
So, I've switched to digital I'm thinking. It's maybe the third issue of the first series. I'm trying to remember how that whole process kind of worked. What happened was I started off traditional with the intent that I would like to try to switch to a digital workflow method. My hope was that I was going to get faster. Hasn't really proven to be the case, but I started experimenting with kind of a hybrid penciling. Traditionally, and then inking digitally. But then as I became more comfortable with it, I just switched to digital only by the end of the first series. And the second series is just all digital.
Now, again, this is a silly question that I should know the answer to. Was this the first time that you had inked yourself, like on a regular basis, or had you done that before?
No, I've inked my own work on a couple, when I first started getting my first work at Marvel, I did some work in the independents and I inked my own work, and I wasn't the greatest at it, but I enjoyed, the fact that the end result was pretty much closer to what I had in my head. And over the course of my career, I've certainly been lucky to work with a ton of great inkers. So I got a chance to ink some of my own work on the Thor Core miniseries. I got a chance to ink the first couple issues of Warlock and the Infinity Watch, but the problem I had was I just wasn't fast enough. So it became a situation where I just had to start penciling my own work. So really, on a regular basis, I'm trying to think. The next time I would have been linking my own work on a regular basis over what ended up to be three miniseries was on Rough Riders for Aftershock. I inked all that myself. So Edgeworld ended up being kind of the second go around of me getting a chance to ink myself on a regular basis.
Now, switching gears, obviously, you and when I first reached out to you with, you know, the podcast was coming back, this was in the summer, and you got announced to be doing a brand new book with Tom DeFalco, which was really exciting to see you guys working together again. So this is the let me see if I can get the full title right. This is the Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars Battle World.
Yes. It's quite a mouthful. Yes, that's it.
It is a mouthful. So I'm very curious, you know, what was it like to, I mean, obviously Marvel's been working on more of these, for lack of a better term, nostalgia miniseries, where they kind of go back in time and they do something kind of in the raindrops type of thing and kind of set in that continuity. And because you have someone like Tom, it's literally a panel drop, like, which I love.
That was great.
Like, you know, if other people are like, oh, it's around that time period. It's like, nope, there's this exact moment. I'm going to tell my story there between these panels. And I love it. At what point, I guess, did you first hear about this project and that you were going to be working with Tom on it?
I reached out to Tom when I think another project was finishing up. So I started contacting, you know, people that I've worked with in the past and like to work with again and say, hey, if you know, have any projects coming up? And my understanding was, I think that this was a possible project for, I think Ron Friends was supposed to do it, but he couldn't do it from a scheduling standpoint. So my timing was good, you know, I reached out to Tom. And he said that, you know, he's working on this project. So then he suggested me to the editors at Marvel. They liked it, liked the idea that that I would come on board. I think what helped me was not only my, you know, a fairly traditionally influenced artist in this business, but that idea, that panel drop, that kind of finding a point in the story to then develop a larger story, weaving in around pre-existing continuity. With my background in Untold Tales of Spider-Man, I think that was kind of a no-brainer as well. You know, I went through the process of, suggested me, the editors at Marvel liked the idea, and then we were off and running.
Now, again, you're moving away from, you know, you just did creator-owned, you were penciling and inking, and now you're back on a more traditional project, and you're doing just pencils. So what was that? Was that any change in your mind to be like, okay, I got to remember, I'm just doing pencils now? Like, did you have to think about it differently?
No, actually, I'm inking this myself.
Oh, are you? I didn't realize that.
Yep.
Oh, you know what? You're right. I didn't realize. Yeah, you're right. You know what? My mind thought that I know that John Calise is a color artist, but for some reason, I was like, oh, he's inking now. Nope, that was wrong.
Right. No, and that's certainly understandable because for the majority of my career, I just penciled only, so... I was able to, based on the deadlines and, that seemed to be doable from a deadline standpoint that I could pencil ink my own work. And I certainly jumped at the chance when it was offered. So I got a chance to ink it myself. Now, from a storytelling standpoint, you know, you go from a science fiction Western to more traditional superheroes, which was a lot of fun. It was it's exercising old muscles that I haven't used in a little while. But there was a little bit, I have to admit, you know, as comfortable as I am working with Tom and working in this genre, it did take a little bit of my brain to kind of reset itself and go, okay, I'm telling a superhero story and not a science fiction Western. So it did take a little bit of getting used to, but because, you know, I love these characters and, I love the idea, and Tom and I worked together in the past. It became comfortable pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. One thing it's a visual affectation that I really enjoy is Spider-Man getting injured and webbing up his arm. I don't know why.
I know, right?
Yeah. Visually, yeah. I've always liked that. I think one of the first times I ever saw it actually was by Ron in his run with Tom DeFalco on Amazing Spider-Man. So seeing that kind of visual language, and I think he was actually... with the black costume at that time as well. So again, something about the black costume and a web sling just really works for me.
Absolutely. I love the idea. Absolutely.
But like, so what is it? Because I would imagine that's kind of an interesting extra visual challenge in terms of storytelling, because you have this character who's well known for being you know, very acrobatic and agile moving around, very and you're giving him an impediment, and you have to kind of find a way to convey that visually in a way that makes sense. Is that a challenge, or is that just kind of an interesting thing to be able to add?
Well, it was both. It was interesting, but it was also a challenge, just because I had to remember, was that, you know, when I read the script, that, you know, I would start to get ideas from my old time on, you know, Spider-Girl and Untold Tales, that kind of stuff. There are certain, like, their visuals just kind of come to my head in terms of the acrobatic nature of the Spider-Man character. And, oh, he could do this, he could do this. And I had to stop myself for a minute and say, wait a second, he's only got one arm he can use in this scene. So that, you know, I had to change his position in a panel or change how he would, you know, fire his webs and that kind of thing. So it did, you know, it did create a little bit more of a challenge design-wise and how to handle the action scenes and really where to also sometimes where I had to place him in the panel so that it could still be read in the right direction, you know, if he's firing a web or whatever. And him only having the use of one arm, you know, did create a challenge on occasion.
Did you call Tom and be like, look what you're doing to me?
Not that he would care. He wouldn't care. No. It was fun. It was just, it was fun. It was a great idea. I liked the bit. And like I said, it was challenging at times, but it was a lot of fun.
I didn't realize how much I missed your interpretation of Human Torch. Like, there's just something really... really cool about the line work they use, because am I remembering wrong? He was in at least one issue of Untold Tales, right?
He was, yeah, he was. Issue 6, I think.
Yeah, that seems right.
One of my favorite issues. Yeah, so it's, and those two together is such a classic team up, you know, Human Torch and Spider-Man. So it's just so much fun to get to draw them. When I read the script and found out that the two of them were going to be you know, this little kind of buddy thing in the beginning, especially, it was a lot of fun. So part of my approach to drawing the Human Torch did come from looking at the original Marvel Secret Wars series, the work that Mike Zeck had done. How was the Human Torch handled in that respect? So. You know, Mike had done kind of a more traditional Human Torch with the lines, you know, delineating, you know, the different muscle structures and the way the flames work. So I wanted to be mindful of that. I didn't necessarily feel that I constantly had to reference the original series all the time, and other than when we did the flashbacks, which were super fun. But things like how to handle the Human Torch and how to handle the line work and everything, that was something I did want to make sure I looked at back to see how Mike was handling it.
I especially enjoy your interpretation of the kind of the God Doom when, you know, he's towering over everyone, because like that's a challenging visual to not look silly, and I thought you did a great job at it.
Thanks. Oh, I appreciate that. That was one of my favorite shots. I really. I wanted to make sure that that he did look, you know, we were trying to get a lot of information across fairly quickly when we're dealing with the flashback. So you want to make sure that, you know, the reader gets the information that they need. We touch base with the original series. But, you know, from a visual standpoint, we can't spend the entire first issue just catching everybody up. So you have a certain amount of time that you can use to get across these flashbacks. So space at times was an issue, but I wanted to make sure that I tried to get as much drama out of that as I could. I was super happy with it. So that was a lot of fun.
There's a flashback shot you do of the heroes and villains kind of lining up about to fight each other. And to your point of there's so much you're trying to visually convey, it feels like, I don't know who's behind one of the word balloons, but I feel like, unfortunately, someone's obscured by a word balloon, and I'm trying to figure out which villain it was.
I don't know. Actually, I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and check. But I was trying to balance enough space so that the word balloons would fit in seamlessly, but also get across the visuals as best that I could. So yeah, I might have cramped the panels a little bit too much on occasion, especially in those big, you know, multi-character flashback panels.
I always wonder when people have to do those types of panels with so many characters, if everyone's just like, how did George Perez do this?
Yes, I did think about that, because I'm certainly no George Perez. So that's not, he had a special gift for sure.
For sure. Now, in a book like this, obviously, I mean, because of the time period, you get to do Spider-Man in his black costume. Now, I'm trying to remember, have you drawn Spidey in his black costume before? Like, actually, Peter as Black Spider-Man?
Never. Never. In fact, I remember talking to Ron about it. No one ever, I'm pretty sure about this, but I don't think anyone's ever asked me to draw the black costume Spider-Man even for a commission.
Really?
I might be wrong about that, but I don't think that ever drawn him in a commission, maybe a convention sketch, but I'm not even sure it was a convention sketch. This may be the very first time I've ever drawn Spider-Man as black costume.
Would you think about it?
it was great. I mean, I wanted to make sure I got the legs of the spider right as it, you know, kind of comes around his body, and handling the black, how to handle the black muscle structure so that the character still looked sleek, but also, you know, you wanted to maintain that he was in a black costume. So I didn't want to make sure that there was too much open space for color, but enough open space to delineate the muscle structure. And but it was a lot of fun. I really liked the costume. Really liked the costume.
I mean, it looks like you're having a lot of fun. Like, again, what I like about it, and this is also a credit to Kaliza on colors, is it's a very dynamic looking book. There's, you know, you got the, there's a page here where you go from like this more kind of icy structure to suddenly it's like this crazy, like, I don't even know what's happening on the page, bright colors, everything's very crazy. And then you get dropped into like a desert situation and it's very different color palette. And I loved how the colors kind of influence the mood. Obviously, that's not specifically you, but how it kind of influences the art as well, and really gave it a very different vibe, which then gets ratcheted up even more when you have Johnny show up.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we got very lucky to get John on board. I mean, he's just, he just killed it. I mean, he just, it was just a beautiful book. And in large part to having him on board. I mean, he was able to handle, not only, you know, all these multiple character panels, but also he was able to handle the different locations. And we did move the character around through different portals and in different places, different planets. That was really incumbent on him to be able to pull that off, to make sure the environments looked unique into themselves and create the proper mood and to get all the characters colored right, which he did a fantastic job with. I mean, I could not be happier with him on the book.
Now, was this your first time drawing Crusher Creel?
I'm trying to think. I don't think so. I think I drew him. I might have drawn him back on maybe sometime when I was on filling on. Like maybe fill on Thor or Thor Core miniseries or something. I don't remember if I know he. I don't. We didn't end up getting around to him on Untold Tales, and I don't think that I ever drew him at Spider Girl. So it might not have been the first time, but I have not been able to draw him very often. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed your interpretation. Like, there's just something about, like, again, the way you do kind of faces and heads really worked for him. Obviously, he's bald, so he doesn't have any hair you have to worry about. But just something about his face and his muscular structure, like, I thought you did a really good job of really channeling, like, that core Crusher Creel feel. And I really enjoyed him being on fire with Human Torch's powers, which was just a cool visual.
Yeah. I mean, that's such a great, and that's Tom. I mean, he knows these characters so well. That's such a great bit for that character. Anything he touches, he's absorbing. So you're at one point he's on fire, then he's got the rock structure, and so yeah, I mean, it was great fun to get to draw that. And again, that goes back to also to John having to make sure that, you know, everything's colored correctly and it's got the right mood and excitement. And but yeah, I really enjoy drawing the character.
No, again, I apologize. I'll probably say up front that there's going to be some spoilers here, but you get to use a character who is on future covers, so I don't think this is as big of a spoiler, but you do get to use the Hobgoblin, and he's an interesting one because of, you know, who was drawing him at the time. Obviously, it would have been Ron. Obviously, he was created by John Meter Jr., but then Ron kind of made him his own, too. So what was it like for you to kind of channel, you know, a specific iteration that he would have kind of looked like at this time? Like, were you looking at reference material from the mid-80s when this would have been happening? Or did you just kind of, you already know the Hobgoblin, didn't have to worry about it? Or were you kind of trying to channel
Ron? I did want to make sure that I kind of looked back. The editors were aware of this, too. That we did want to try to be time-specific, that we tried to get it, you know, close to where he was supposed to be, what he's supposed to look like at that time. So I did pull out some reference. I did do some searching to try to make sure that that he looked correct for the time period. So, but he was, that was great. It was absolutely great.
I'll have to send Tom a note at some point, but I love that he has a moment where he says the Hobgoblin lives, and I'm like, well, that's a very famous miniseries that I love. I don't know if that was on purpose or not.
No, I'm not sure yet. I thought Tom would know the answer to that, but it was a nice touch.
Now, obviously, you can't spoil what's coming up, you know, in the next few issues. But, you know, how much of a blast has it been being able to work on something that, again, is I don't think I'm stepping in it to say that it's classic hoo-ha action, right? Like, that's what Tom's bread and butter is. So what is it like to be able to step back into hoo-ha action?
Well, yeah, the good use of the hoo-ha description there. So it was a lot of fun. Like I said, it was something that I have not done in quite a while. You know, I've been very fortunate to do a lot of different kind of projects. You know, I commend everything from Edge World to Rough Riders to even go back to Barbed Wire. And I mean, there was a lot of books that I did that really were not. Kind of classic Marvel big time superhero story. So it's been a long time since I had a chance to do that. So it was so much fun to step back into that world, especially working with Tom and getting a chance to work with these characters. I mean, having Johnny show up in the first issue and having the two of them interact. And that's the other great thing, the way Tom writes these characters. Their interaction was just so great. And they bicker back and forth and bust each other's chops, and that dynamic is just so much fun. So getting a chance to draw those characters was great. You know, there are characters that are coming up in the next several issues that that I was you know, I was a fan of when I was a kid. A couple of them I never had a chance to draw before. It's just made the whole project exciting, fun to be a part of.
For sure. When you transition into working with Tom again, because obviously you guys have a long, you know, long-standing collaboration, but it has been a little while. After having worked with Chuck on something that was so intensely personal to you both, what was the switch in vibe like?
Well, it was different because Tom and Chuck are different. You know, they're both very talented. They both tell great stories, but they tell stories in different ways. Mm-hmm. It was also a challenge. In terms of the page layouts, because I had to remember that I wasn't drawing for guided view, you know, as I had been on Edgeworld for almost 2 years, is that, you know, we had to make sure that each panel was a standalone panel, that there was more of a grid structure. You can't really break any panel borders, no overlapping panels, because, you know, we had certain restrictions for guided view. And then to step back into a more, essentially traditional Marvel superhero story where I could play around more with panel design and panel layout. And, you know, that took a little getting used to and, you know, kind of remembering what that was like, you know. But Tom made it easy just because, like you said, we worked together in the past and very comfortable with how he tells the story. And, you know, I hope I did it justice.
I have a really odd question, but I'm just curious because obviously you're used to drawing Spider-Man in the red and blues. Now you're doing them in the blacks. What was it like handling the eyes? Because the eyes are kind of a slightly different Like they do feel different on the black costume. So what was it like managing the eyes? Was that difficult?
One of the first things that I did was I pulled up reference on Ron's version of the black costume. Just because, for all kinds of reasons. I mean, obviously, Ron is, enormously talented. But I always liked the way the eyes worked when he drew them. So I don't know if I was able to pull that off as much. I tried my best. But I had reference. I did have reference in front of me on how Ron was handling the eyes. I always thought he did a great job and just tried to approximate that as best I could.
So what I'm hearing is, if it didn't work, it's really Ron's fault.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. So everybody direct your criticism to him. I'm not listening.
I'll let you go in just a moment, but what, is there anything else you can kind of tease us about, in terms of some of the visuals that we're going to be getting from you?
Well, I don't want to say too much other than just, it's the story definitely builds. I mean, more characters are added. More character interaction happens, both from a villain standpoint, a hero standpoint. More gets revealed as you move through the story as to who is behind this, what this all kind of means, especially for Spider-Man. Beyond that, I can only say you're going to have to pick up the books.
What I really want to know is he going to get that snack?
I definitely can't cop to that.
Okay, fair enough. Well, again, Pat, thank you so much for taking the time and chatting with me about this. If possible, when the trade of Edgeworld comes out, it'd be actually wonderful to have you and Chuck both on again to kind of break it down, if you'd be open to it.
Absolutely. We would love to do that.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much. People should definitely check out Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars Battle World. Whew, take a breath. It's first issue. I mean, I think this episode is actually going to come out the day of the first issue. So it's going to be November the 22nd. And it's what, 4 issues, correct?
Correct.
All right. So people better pick up all 4 issues. So hopefully we can get maybe more action from you and Tom in the future.
Absolutely. I would love it.
All right, Pat. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Adam, it's always a pleasure. I appreciate it. Thank you.